Welcome to Analytics of Dynasty, a daily podcast. We have a Sunday strategy session here, the first Sunday strategy session after the release of the Analytics of Dynasty team building guide. So a little bit of a rework on the marketing of this for sure. I think it's a little bit of a rework on the content of the book for sure as well. I was going overarching. I talked about it in the Q&A. I wanted to sort of go global, go big in terms of like the thought process behind this one and try something sort of comprehensive. So as you're sort of getting into this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the Sunday strategy session, obviously, and then it's going to be about one of the chapters. It's chapter 9. I did some content on this draft last offseason. This was a May draft that I did, so post rookie draft, and I want to sort of go through some of the stuff that I did in it. Some of the lessons we learned. This is part of the book, so you sort of get some additional stuff in here. Because again, startup draft season is teeing up right around the corner, or already is here, right? Just kind of be thinking about it longer term, right? So this was a 12-team Superflex draft. This was a safe leagues draft. 28-man roster, start 10, one quarterback, two running backs, three wide receivers, one tight end, one Superflex, and, of course, two traditional flex positions, six-point passing touchdown, negative 4 points for an interception, traditional PPR scoring, but a 2 PPR premium for tight ends. All right, so tight ends scoring twice as much as the rest of the positions at catching passes. I did this, and I wrote most of this post-draft, actually. If this sounds familiar, a lot of this was actually written contemporaneous with me recording the podcast. I will go back and I will link the podcast as well. I'll find it. I believe it was in May or June where I actually did the podcast. It might have been two of them, actually, that I did. So I'll go back and I'll find that. We'll have it, we'll be able to have that content here. I'll give a link to it or whatnot in the show notes for this show. I did this draft, I think, differently maybe than you might do as you're sitting here listening, because I was going to write about it, right? So I knew that there was, that was going to happen. So I thought a little bit differently about it. And when I know I'm going to write about something, when I know there's going to be an audience for it, I try and make it like the absolute best that I can do, right? So I'm not saying I don't give my all to everything, but I think you're super tuned in to it when you are, when you're going to write about it, right? When you do content about it, right? You're super tuned in when there's going to be an audience, right? You know, it's the same thing with anything, like at your work, right? If no one's watching, like you're still doing your job, you might not be, perfect at it. When your boss is sitting there watching, you're going to give it everything you got and you're going to come super prepared. So I kind of knew that was kind of what was going on. So I did plan out a pretty thorough draft plan in advance. I actually went through and I wrote down goals. I was like, ready to go for this draft. The Supermax players were certainly a goal in this. And I really broke it down. I had three different tiers of goals for this team. Two Supermax quarterbacks. And at the time, the Supermax quarterbacks were Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, Justin Herbert, Dak Prescott, Matthew Stafford, and Russell Wilson. Deshaun Watson also qualified, but again, he was going to warrant some decision-making pivots, right? So if I got to him, I was going to have to sort of decide. I was, A, comfortable taking the longer-term bet, but B, I would have to decide, okay, does that mean I'm going to sort of not contend this year? Or, if I'm going to be taking contending pieces, I need another answer at quarterback, right? So that was going to be a pivot play there. So two Supermax quarterbacks, two of those guys. I wanted two top 10 tight ends. And I wanted, those are the two top tier goals. My second tier goals were four top 20 tight ends. I wanted 500 targets in 2022 from the top four wide receivers on my roster. I wanted a 2-to-1 running back to wide receiver ratio. So again, I knew I was going to get that last one probably. The other two are a little bit harder. I don't think they're hard and fast rules or anything like that. Honestly, if you have two Supermax quarterbacks and two top 10 tight ends, and you can land a running back and a receiver like that are above, you know, that are very good in sort of the very good range of the position, you're going to make the playoffs probably. So, you know, I don't necessarily sink too far in terms of going down at any of the, you know, it's if I wouldn't get four top 20 tight ends, I wasn't going to be like, I have to rebuild, right? Not a crisis level goal, but an aspiration, right? And then the final tier that I had was some additional future draft pedigree. So I drew the 112-201 in this draft. Again, it was just a random deal. And in the months leading up to that, the median ADPs for Deshaun Watson was 110. The median for Dak Prescott, 111. I was unlikely to get both players was sort of my assumption at that turn. Mahomes, Allen, Herbert. We're going top three. Stafford was going sort of late second round into the third round type range. So that was kind of what I was going to have to deal with, right? Picking, trying to execute the strategy at 112-201, not optimal. Much rather do it at 106 and 207, right? I think that's a much more optimized spot to try and execute this. You know, even, right, I'd rather be even higher, right? You know, 103 and 210. Is better than you know than picking at the turn at 112 and 201. So I already knew sitting there, right, as I sort of lay out my goals, I know that I'm going to probably have a problem executing this. Right, is probably my, or I'm going to sit at 201 and not love picking a guy like Russell Wilson or Stafford that early. Right, that's kind of how I knew this would turn out. So I made a pretty strong move up the board. I was hesitant to sort of trade a future first, but I said basically I have two goals in a trade up. Well, three goals. Number one, I want to get in the top three. Number two, I want to do so without moving both of my picks at the turn. So including only one of 112 and 201, right? So I wanted to still pick at that turn with one of the picks. I didn't want to give up a future first, right? So get in the top three, keep one of those picks, not give up a future first. Anything else, I basically would have given. That was kind of what I went in there with. The trade ends up being 201, 312, 512 for 102, 611, and 702. By my math, for what this is worth, I equated this to being 702 and 512 being the same. Right, they're different. Obviously, it's a round different. Obviously, that's a flat enough tier. I didn't care, so I just sort of like, yeah, you want a whatever a 13 pick upgrade, whatever that is, 14 pick upgrade, whatever that is. You want that? Fine, take it. Right, I got what I accomplished. No first round pick, got in the top three, and I still got to pick at 112. Bingo. Job done. Perfect. The other, I guess if there's another goal that I had in it, it would have been to come out pick neutral, right? So I was pick neutral, right? I wasn't giving up three picks to get two, for example. Pick neutral. So perfect. Done deal. Patrick Mahomes available to me at 102. Bang. So I then come up to, yeah, I wait the whole first round. And thank goodness I did. Deshaun Watson, Dak Prescott go off at 110 and 111. And so I'm sitting there again, kind of with the problem that I thought I would face, which is I'm going to have to pick a quarterback here that is ahead of price. So it would have been Watson, Stafford. It would have been Wilson, Stafford. And I thought this is too early. They were like mid to later second round picks at that point. Wasn't what I wanted to do. So I said, you know, I'll go and I'll trade down. And so I trade down 112 for 205 in a future second. And that got me, you know, right where I wanted to get. So that's perfect. And then I think Wilson went off the board someplace in here as well. And then, so I get to 205. Stafford was still there. I am a little too probably aggressive at this point. I trade 205 for 208 and a future second, and end up landing Stafford. There was a quarterback that went in the range as well. I can't remember who it was, but it was a tight squeeze there, probably unnecessary. I believe Wilson went in the range. So I think that was where Wilson went, right in that range as well. So I was a little, like, that was a little tight for me to land the plane. But what do? I get two future seconds. I accomplish really the goal of getting ahead on pedigree already, right? And I'm identifying flat rounds to do that in. That's good. Get Stafford 208. Then I'm waiting a while. And I'm starting to watch the tight ends go. Pitts goes, Andrews goes, Kelsey goes. And they went kind of quicker than I expected. I wasn't sure. I thought Kelsey might stay a little bit. But they'll go kind of in that third round range. And I don't really love it. So I said, well, all right, I'm at 401, and I kind of want to make sure I get one of these tight ends, right? I want to get really that two top tight ends is I want one of basically Pitts, Andrews, Kelsey, and Kittle, right? Waller would have been in there as well at the time. Plus someone else in the top 10. That's really how that breaks down, right? So four of them are off the board. The fifth one's available. I basically am able to give 401, which is my pick, my second for 309, and that person's third. I move up. I get Kittle at 309. And then I'm sitting there waiting forever, right? So at this point, I am basically pick neutral in second-round picks, and I've got an extra I have an extra second-round pick and an extra third-round pick at this point. But I have to wait a long time. So 601. I was surprised throughout the whole wait. Hockenson goes 404. Waller goes 512. I thought there was a chance I was going to get up and be able to get Waller in that point. Get to 512. I tried trading up. Unsuccessful. And I said, okay, Goddard falls to me. 601. Bang. Easy pick for me. Right. So I get two Supermax quarterbacks, two tight ends off the board. I've seen different constructions of this as being the first, right? Basically that late 112 and a first for one of those top three picks. I like the way that board felt better because it allowed you to get Kittle, Kelsey. It allowed you to get a tier up at tight end, right? That's really where this trade cost me. So I would just sort of note that, right? I don't mind doing that. Again, that follows our rules. If you're going to trade a first round pick, it better be for an elite player, top 30 player. Like, it's fine to do that in that range, right? So, and even if you're trading among super max guys, it's still an upgrade. So that was certainly my position there. I get a little bit later down into the sixth round range. Late into the sixth round, and I'm sort of monitoring, Aaron Jones, David Montgomery, Cam Akers, Leonard Fournette, kind of in that range. There is a lot of guys there. I received multiple offers to really move up, to move back, I should say. Someone wanted to give me 9-11 in a second. I didn't really love that idea, even though it was just too far out of the range. I still wanted to sort of draft some guys that could really help me in that 7th, 8th round range. I didn't want to move all the way back to the end of the 9th round. I thought that would be too far. But I got a deal to move from 702 to 706 and a future 3rd. So that was good. I then trade 706 and my future 1st for Christian McCaffrey. Again, keeping true to principles, you trade top. If you can get a top 30 asset, you can include a future 1st. I did that. It would have been like Aaron Jones probably at that cost. But I thought that that would have probably been my pick. So I went up and I get McCaffrey. And then at the end of the 7th round, I get Josh Jacobs. So first, basically, six players off the board: Mahomes, Stafford, Kittle, Goddard, McCaffrey, Jacobs. No wide receivers, which will be a trend that you will see continue throughout this. I give 801 for 1104, a future 2nd and a future 3rd. So again, I'm replenishing the picks. Excuse me, a future 4th. So I'm replenishing the picks at this point. I got 3 seconds. I have 3/3 at this point, and I've got 2/4, right? So just kind of replenishing the picks. Thought it was a flat range. Was probably going to go wide receiver at that point, but I said it's pretty flat. I can sort of wait. pick six comes to me, and it was really came down. There was a lot of discussion about this pick. It was really came down to like, do I go Allen Robinson, Brandon Cooks range of the position? I could go Sky Moore. I could take Jameis Winston. That was really my decision process. I ultimately settled on Jameis Winston with the intent of, you know, hey, scarcity, right? Give me a quarterback that can really make a difference. And that was kind of the decision point there. Brandon Cooks, 9-12, was the first wide receiver off the board. And then I make another trade. I give 10-01 for 13-03 and 13-11. Again, if you can do trades like that, right, adding multiple picks and flat ranges, I really like it. It ends up not really working out for me in the end, but I think that's the right process, right? That's the odds-based process. You just have to not muck it up quite like I did. Gabe Davis, and again, I'm going through all this because it has a point. Gabe Davis, 11-04, is my wide receiver two. He becomes really the best, you know, becomes the highest useful wide receiver that I draft. Brandon Cooks becomes largely not useful. Zach Ertz, pick 9 at 11-12, and then I, at the turn, go 12-01. It's Tyler Lockett. So how am I doing with my goals at this point? Probably missing the wide receiver goals is really the thought. You know, Brandon Cooks, maybe a buck 20. Gabe Davis, I don't know. Let's give him generously a buck 20. Tyler Lockett, generously a buck 20. So I'm at, what, 360, probably generously, not going to make it to 500. However, at this point, I do have to pivot a little bit because I need basically productive guys to go in my lineup at wide receiver, or I need guys that are really going to outproduce my draft costs. So we'll talk about that in a little bit here as well with one of my next picks. 13-03 and 13-11. Again, this was that trade down from 10-01. Probably would have went like Allen Robinson in the range. You know, that would have been probably the person that I would have went. Robinson went right ahead of me, so he would have been, he was gone by the time that 10-01 pick there. I wrote down at the time I would have went Cooks, Robinson. Instead I go Cordarrelle Patterson, Rob Gronkowski, to basically flesh out the four top 20 tight ends. He was tight end 22 at the time. Five tight ends actually went between Ertz at 11-12 and Gronkowski at 13-11. So I kind of got boxed out on the top 20 guy, but I thought, you know, if he comes back and plays, this is clearly a top 20 guy. So that was kind of my calculus there. I had three I felt really good about. Four, the fourth one was kind of a little bit of a dart throw. And then Patterson, I thought, hey, he could be he's probably an every week flex consideration for me at that point. Madison, 13-12, Marquez Valdes-Scantling at 14-01. This was a pure, at this point, I needed a ceiling bet, right? My position at this point is, hey, I've got a couple established veterans in Brandon Cooks and Tyler Lockett. I have a young guy who's slotted in to be a wide receiver too on a good offense, so I feel good there. Marquez Valdes-Scantling, a wide receiver 56, is the type of guy that, you know, like the elite physical, at least the elite sort of testing stuff there, his speed, the size that he has, you know, that could fit really well. Like, that's the type of thing that could fit really well. And we could look back in, you know, at this point in January, we could look back and say, well, like, the obvious answer to the who's the next guy for Mahomes was super easy. It was super cheap. And, you know, what were we thinking at letting him fall to wide receiver 56? Again, we know in hindsight that didn't turn out, but that was kind of the bet that I was making. Like, who from this range can really outproduce it? And I thought that he could. Again, that ends up not being successful, but he's kind of an every week sort of flyer in the flex. Brian Robinson and Taron Davis Price, 50 and 51. So basically I accomplished three of my goals. I drafted two supermax quarterbacks, two top 10 tight ends, drafted 13 running backs to only six wide receivers. I missed the opportunity to get 500 targets, but I bankrolled some additional assets to potentially, you know, flesh out the wide receiver position when I needed it, which I end up doing later on. Then I make some trades, right? I do get later on in this draft, I don't go through all of the picks, but I landed some key guys: Samaje Perine, 18-01, Gus Edwards, 19-12, Jacoby Brissett at 20.01, and then Kenyon Drake at 22.01. So Brissett ends up really being a key to this whole thing. There's probably a lesson in here of like just draft a lot of premium positions and sort it out later on. He's a good example of that. But I knew he was going to be a starter, right? And I didn't necessarily know, you know, I assumed that he would be on my bench every week because I'd be starting Mahomes and Stafford. But like I knew I had basically 3 months of Brissett as being a starter, assuming he stayed healthy, and, you know, we could see what the future would bring. So that was an easy one there from way deep down. And I'm surprised he didn't go earlier. But he ends up being critical to this whole thing, right? He actually performs really well. And then, you know, it gets into November, and I'm like, all right, I'm in some trouble because Stafford had just suffered a second concussion, and Brissett is going to be out. And so I say, you know, what's my pivot, right? You know, Brady was available on the market. I needed a quarterback. And Jameis Winston wasn't helping me. So I said, what really do I do? I was able to trade a second and a third for Brady, and they were both probably middle of the round picks. They weren't my own. The person would not take my own. He wanted the ones that had a shot to be middle of the round. And thank God I did it because Brady ends up being a stopgap for me, and I lost Stafford for the season. Didn't know it at the point I made the trade, but I ended up losing for the season. Same week there, I make a couple more trades. I give two third-round picks for Adam Thielen. Again, these were later picks, which I felt fine to, you know, really try and flesh out the wide receiver position. Again, glad that I did because I needed to start him in weeks where Tyler Lockett ends up missing some time. Tyrion Davis Price, I, at that point, kind of saw the writing on the wall, like, hey, this could be a player in the offseason that's not worth anything. There was a David Joku was placed on the trade block. I said, I will go out and acquire David Joku. I would probably trade a first for him in this format. I do not have a first. You know, what's a couple of seconds get me, right? That's kind of my thought process there. And so I go out and I use the seconds. You know, we kind of pivoting around some deals or whatever. He wanted the seconds and Tyrion Davis Price for Joku. And I said, you know, I don't think Tyrion Davis Price could actually get me back a second right now. So let's do it. I do the deal. I get Joku. And I think that's probably the right price. So it felt cheap at the time. So there were a ton of misses, right? Which is really one of the reasons I love talking about this draft so much. I missed a ton. And how did I miss? My second pick missed 7 games. My third pick missed 2. My fourth pick missed 5. My sixth pick missed 13. My seventh pick missed 4. My ninth pick missed 6. And my 10th pick missed 2. So basically, I missed of those 7 guys, basically of the top 10 guys I drafted, Mahomes, Josh Jacobs, and Gabe Davis all played 16 regular season games. And then it was 7 of those guys ended up missing missing those times. It was 35% of games that those guys missed. So those 7 guys. So again, there's a lot of misses in there. Okay, what's the net end result of this? The team was 10-4 and a 768 all play win record. The team drew the 3 seed. I was a bit unlucky and probably should have been higher. I'd scored the second most points, but drew a 3 seed. I think a couple of things are key for this, right? You look back at this deal and you're like, okay, there's some mistakes in there. Like even Kittle didn't perform that well. Goddard was hurt for an extended period of time. Basically, my sixth pick was Jameis Winston, and he didn't even make a difference for me, right? I mean, my seventh pick was Brandon Cooks, and he didn't make a difference for me, right? So there's a lot of misses in there. And that can be debilitating. Right? You can really let that get you down. How did this come to be? It was right directionally. Okay? It was right directionally. It's right where it needs to be. Right? It needs to be elite at quarterback. You need to be drafting the right type of positions. And you need to be focused on scoring a lot of points. Okay? And what that'll allow you to do, and I'll flesh this out a little bit more. I have some additional data stuff once I sort of get through the initial release of this book that I'll sort of circle back through and we'll cover. I've uncovered it. I haven't gotten enough through it to sort of conclusively say what it says. But the general theory is that a lot of the stuff at wide receiver is non-scoring value. right? So a lot of what you're paying for at wide receiver is non-scoring value. And a consequence of that is you get a lot of, you draft a lot of wide receivers, you draft them high, and they don't, they might retain value, but what you're actually giving up is premiums at other positions, right? And a lot of the roster flexibility and the scoring flexibility that if things go wrong, all of a sudden, like, they don't produce the ceiling for you. And so, you know, you can look at it like at different points, Kittle was good. At different points, Goddard helped me, you know, kind of like throughout the season, they were like one, almost one tight end. Like, that's a little bit of a simplification of it, but that's kind of how it turned out to be. And you know, the receiving thing's another is a good indicator of this too, right? I was so lean at wide receiver, that it allowed me to, you know, it basically forced me to be, it allowed me to be good at other positions, right? And the fact that I was willing to wait on wide receiver, willing to sort of wait on those non-scoring, the wait on the non-scoring value of the position to pass, right? And, you know, when you get into the 30s, no one's paying a ton of premium for guys for long-term value. Otherwise, they'd be higher up the position, right? You can get away with sort of being league average. So the two things, elite players can carry you and through a lot of problems, and roster construction is a major advantage. You know, I went back and I looked at this basically through the 14 weeks of the regular season, actually through, I believe it was 16 weeks of the regular season. I measured this out it was the regular season. So I looked at this and I said, you know, what's the, basically, kind of, how did my starting lineup come together? It was 8 games from Patterson, 6 games from Brian Robinson, 2 from P. Ryan. They averaged 11.5 points per game. You know, P. Ryan had a couple big punches. Brian Robinson didn't do a ton for me, but they actually overproduced the average at the running back position, right? The average starts at the running back position, which I think was critical. You know, when you look at, so when you think about that, like, that's good. That is good. That's what you want. And that's primarily a roster construction advantage. You know, the other thing that I looked at was, you know, the team averaged 2 quarterback starts a week, 21.2 points per game, 21.9 running back starts per week. 2.9 running back. I think it's at 29. 2.9 running backs each week with an average of 17.9 points per game. 3 wide receivers a week, exactly 3 wide receivers a week, 12.2 points per game. 2.2 tight ends a week, 16.5 points per game. You know, when you actually go back and you look at it, I had some stuff in here as well that you kind of look back and you think, you know, some of the scoring stuff. And I sort of combined the chapter a little bit. I have two different ones in there. But one of the things that you see is you're able to sort of run up a big advantage at the premium positions at on the top of the quarterback position, top of the tight end position, in terms of starts per game, in terms of points per game, at the top of the running back position. And what happens is, a wide receiver, you're league neutral. And that's how Gabe Davis, is being wide receiver 2, can make a big edge for you. Right, that's how he can make a big edge for you. So ultimately, this team, again, with a lot of problems. Right? This isn't some fairy tale. And I picked this team in advance to write about. Right, if I wanted to pick a better team, like, there was probably teams I could have picked from. I picked this one to write from the beginning. I did content on it from the beginning, and it wasn't perfect. It won the league. Okay, it won the league, and I think the lesson that you take from that is a couple of things. Elite players matter. Roster construction matters. And, you know, if you're sort of always thinking about that, right, it covers up, it masks a lot of ills, right? Mahomes is the college basketball team that can go out and hit, you know, 15 threes in a game. If you hit 15 threes in a game, you're probably going to win, right? You're probably going to win. I went through and I did some research on it, actually. When my second daughter was born, it was March Madness, Syracuse was in the tournament. So I went back and I looked. It's surprisingly difficult to get data on college basketball, by the way. But bets aside, I went back and I looked at it, and it was, it was something like, if you had made more than a dozen threes, like, your, your win rate went like through the roof. Like it was like you were even the underdogs that made it. Again, the sample size wasn't that big, but like even the underdogs that made you know, like a dozen threes were better than 50% chance to win. Like it just really was a, you know, and if you hit that many, right, you're gonna have a really good chance. That's the deal with Mahomes, right? That's the deal with McCaffrey. That's the deal with Josh Jacobs this year. That's the deal with the tight ends, right? They're just putting you at such a different level. It masks a lot of ills. Okay, so that's really the you know, kind of the big thing that I came away from a lot of the stuff in this league, in this chapter, is just how much of a difference that elite players can make. And when you start looking at it, it can be a really, it can be hard in advance, right? And this is why I like to talk about this stuff now. It can be really hard in advance to think about like, oh, all right, do I want to sacrifice stuff for my, my team depth, right? My wide receiver two, it's going to cost me my wide, you know, maybe a running back two, to go up and trade for an elite quarterback. And at this point in the calendar, the answer is always the elite quarterback, right? Because A, everything can revolve around them, and B, like they're the most stable thing, right? To for those deals to lose, they almost always need to be, you always almost need to be lucky on the other side of it for you to actually lose that deal. So I do have as well some data that I pulled from the draft in terms of some actual ranks of where I actually fell. And it was funny because when you actually look at it, it ended up being, you know, different than, let me just see if I got it here. I ended up starting throughout the season four quarterbacks, six running backs, which I actually thought was lower than the number that I would have expected. Six wide receivers and four tight ends were the players in my lineup, which I think, again, you start 20 players in your lineup basically the whole season. That's actually not that many, right? You would think it'd be more than that. That was pretty in line with some of the stuff that I thought, that I saw from some other stuff as well. When I looked at some other leagues and some other teams and stuff, that seemed about consistent with it in a 10-man, in this 10-man format. So I thought that was a pretty interesting thing to sort of take a peek at. And you ultimately see, like, again, in that world where you're sort of shuffling through some different teams, you're shuffling through some different players, and what you end up seeing is there's such a big difference about the guys that are playing, that big number of, those big number of points, and those big numbers of weeks for you, all the other guys can sort of come and go. I did look at some of the stuff in terms of some average scoring points. I mentioned that a second ago. If you actually look at here, let me just check here. There we go. If you look, I ranked at quarterback. I had the second most points to quarterback position. Again, starting two quarterbacks every week, and I averaged the third most points in the league amongst my quarterback starts. Again, 28 starts, and basically per those each one of those starts, I had the third highest number. I had the second most running back points. Started 2.86 running backs per week. That actually was league neutral, right? I actually ranked sixth in the league among starters. I ranked number one in average points, in average starter points. So again, really, really benefiting there from Jacobs and making the move for McCaffrey. I started literally three wide receivers, and that was the fewest by a substantial amount. The next smallest number was 3.3. So I was basically almost a third of a wide receiver below the next lowest team. I literally started three every week. So of course I ranked 12th in scoring. Of course I did, right? I didn't supply enough to score that many. However, when you actually look at, you know, what am I trying to do? The most points in my lineup. How do I get the most points in my lineup? Well, it's to maximize every lineup spot. Where did my wide receivers rank in terms of average points per game? 7th. 7th. They ranked right in the middle of the position in terms of the average points that they average. Again, this is a core of characters that includes Brandon Cooks, Gabe Davis, Tyler Lockett, Marquez Valdez-Scantling, and a late traded for Adam Thielen. Okay, that team got me to league average in terms of the average points to start. Wasn't trying to do more than that, and by not trying to do a ton more than that, by not trying to roster 4.5 of them, not trying to keep up with the Joneses, what happened, right? Dominance at running back, at quarterback, at tight end, and then dominance at running back as well, right? That's what happens, right? 2.14 tight ends per week I started. That was good for the first, and then that was during the regular season. I think it was 2.2 during the entire season, and then second and total average and the average points per tight end start, right? So when you really look at it, it's really running up the scores at the premiums and sort of sacrificing. You can't do everything. Right, you can't do everything. So the question is kind of, I think of it in three buckets. If you're looking at different positions, again, I talk about this in the Fix It series as well. What positions sort of rank where, right? Which are the positions that you will win because of? Which positions are you going to win with? And which positions are going to cause you not to win? Or you're going to win in spite of, right? I think the key is to make it so that way no positions are causing you to lose, but you're neutral at two, right? You can win with two, and you're going to win because of two. If you can get to a spot, and I think that we can, this is a good example of this. I think we can at running back, sort of plan on saying, hey, this is a position that I'm going to win with. I'm probably not going to win because of it because I'm not going to go early on. But I'm going to sort of set it up so that I can win with this position. I'm going to win at quarterback. I'm going to win because of my tight end, win because of those two positions. And I can win with my running back position, with the volume stuff. And I can win at wide receiver because I'm playing super optimally efficient. And that's kind of the formula. What will turn out to be in both of the case studies of this, you actually turn that running back position into being a you will win because of. Doing that, right? But I don't spend like I'm trying to do that. I spend like I'm trying to win with it instead of because of it. So I think just thinking about those things, it's important. The other thing I gathered, again, this is super, I didn't really include a ton of this in the book, but this is sort of my working theory. When you actually look at some of the stuff, it's interesting about sort of what correlates to the scoring and what correlates to success. So if you actually looked at the total points scored by position, right? If you're sort of trying to predict, if you're looking at what predicts how you rank in overall scoring, you can look at it a couple of different ways. You can look at each position as a whole, the total points that you score at those positions, or you can look at it on a per game basis, right? On a per start basis. So what you see is about 20% of your total scoring is predicted by quarterbacks, which is actually funny because that's 20% of your lineup. And two of your more high-powered positions, right, presumably on an average basis, but only accounts for its weight, which I think is interesting and something we're going to have to delve into a little bit more as we sort of go along here. I'm interested by that fact because I thought it would explain more. Running back scoring accounted for 23.1%. of the variance, right? So explain 23.1% of the total points. Wide receiver total points scored accounted for 20.65% of the total points, right? That was it explained 20, just short of 21% of the total points. And tight end came in really low at explaining only about 9.7% of the total points. When you take it from the total points scored, right? When you say, all right, well, the total points at quarterback, total points at running back, total points at wide receiver, total points at tight end, what does it explain of total points? When you take a step back and you say, all right, what's the actual points per start explain about your total points at the end of the season? All right. Quarterback, it jumps up to just over 20%. Again, that's right around what you would expect. It was just below 20%. In total points, it's just above it in points per start. But 47.6% of the all play, or of the total points at the end of the season, right, your total points, is explained by your points per start at running back, which is a large amount. That's almost 50%. 45% for wide receiver. Again, what's more important, total wide receiver points or wide receiver points per start? Substantially more important, wide receiver points per start. Right, that's substantially more predictive. And then tight end is the big one. It jumps from, again, we said it was 9.6% at the total tight end points, explained 9.6% of the total points where you ranked at the end of the season. 35.5%. It explains of the total points, the points per start explains of the total points at the end of the season for your team. So what does that signal? Well, tight end, you know, getting tight end right and getting it efficient is a weapon, right? Wide receiver, it's a lot more important to be sort of optimized per start than it is, you know, per the overall position. Right. Those are really the big things I draw from that. Right. Sort of you're thinking about your wide receiver position, not as a unit, but you're thinking of it as 42. You know, this is you start three in a 14-week season. This is a 42 puzzle piece problem. This is a 42 lineup spots issue. Right. And can I sort of optimize those? And if I'm allowed to, if I am capable of optimizing those to basically being league neutral, I'm probably going to be close to a bye, right, with the right roster construction. Again, I didn't spend on the wide receiver position until the 40s, and I basically fought them to a draw. And if you can tell me that I'm going to do that, I'm going to be winning a lot of money. So that's some of the lessons from this. Again, this is deeper than the book, but, I think it's helpful to sort of, you know, where I can flesh out some stuff that sort of I'm thinking about in addition to the book that doesn't necessarily make the book. I think it's helpful. So, yeah, so that's just some stuff that, you know, I think helps me. Again, big takeaways, right? Premium positions matter. Premium players really matter. You can mess up a lot of stuff. And if you're sort of right there, you're going to be right. You're going to be in the right direction. Optimize at the wide receiver position. Don't keep up with the Joneses, right? Score as many points as you can. But by sacrificing some of that dynasty bikini season value at the receiver position, you can really make a big difference in terms of, scoring what you need to score, which is basically just getting by. You know, I took the bar exam. I employed a strategy similar to this. I couldn't, for the life of me, when I studied for it, I couldn't understand New York law. And I went to Ohio Northern, and I didn't learn New York law at Ohio Northern. And you don't learn a ton of law, but in some of the, you know, you do some civil practice, you do some criminal procedure and that sort of stuff. And the professors are going to sort of focus on focused on the local law, which would have been Ohio law. We don't do a ton of law in terms of like reading different books. It's different than you would think. But I wasn't exposed to any New York law. So I basically came in, and the way you study for the bar, you basically get like 8 or 9 weeks, depending on sort of when you start. And you sort of spend all that time studying, and then you go take the bar. So I graduated in December, and then I went in... studied all January and all February. And so I, like 3 weeks into it, was trying to learn all this New York law. And then the law isn't that much different than the general sort of law that you learn. But there are differences. And I couldn't remember them, like for the life of me. And so I basically employed a strategy of saying, like, I was really good on the general law, right, which is actually becomes multiple choice questions. And the way my mind worked, it was super easy to remember those. It was super easy to apply them. And I was really good at it. I sucked at the New York law. And so I kind of said to myself, like, all right, well, let's use a strategy. All right, let's try and think this through. How am I better off spending my time? And so I kind of came to the conclusion of, like, even if I have to sort of study New York law and I have to write New York law, even if I get the law wrong and I sort of write it okay, Yeah, I'm going to get points. I don't take a zero for not knowing the exact rule in New York law. But if I know the exact law in the other day, which is your multiple choice, that's your general law questions, I will, A, largely be able to apply that knowledge, or not, some of that knowledge will apply to the New York stuff, but I can run up such a score at that position, that at that part of the test, that I can get away with a subpar performance on the New York State bar and pass it, right? The New York State test, which is, I believe, the first day. So one of the first day, again, I did all this stuff. I prepped all this stuff. I was doing excellent at all the multiple choice questions. And I went in the first day and I really struggled. And I knew it was going to be a struggle. It was a struggle. I'm still convinced to this day I didn't have a page of the test. You can't convince me otherwise. There was a package that you had to read during it. And they give you, you know, a fact pattern basically. And they're like, all right, write an essay about it. And it was, I'll never forget this, about the negative commerce clause. And there was a case in there, you're supposed to, there was a part about the negative commerce clause that you were supposed to be able to have in a packet, and it was not there. And I'm certain it wasn't there, because I looked and I looked and I looked and I looked and I knew I needed it. Couldn't find it. And so I just had to apply what the rule was. And so I just did my best. And I was like, there's, that page was not in there. And so I left like all sorts of out of sort. I'm like, did my strategy mess up? Did my strategy mess up? So I went into the next day. I was like, I kind of knew, you know, this is the deal. Like, you need your quarterbacks to come through. This was that strategy. And so I take the test and I came out of it and I was like, I think I got every question right. And I had just done, right? I knew that the strategy was to apply it, what was I was strong at, and just crush that. And I said, just try and get every one of them right. And I thought I was, the way the test set up, I thought I was capable of that, because it was just how I understood the law was like super applicable to that. A lot of people think that day is hard. My mind just is suited for that day better than any other. And so I ended up like sort of killing that section, and it almost didn't matter what I got in the New York bar, and I passed it. So the New York day of the bar, and I passed it. So that whole negative commerce clause thing is just a footnote in history, and it's nice. But that harkens back to this, right? If you sort of know what you need to get by with at the one position, and you can really run up the score where A, we're good, and B, we sort of know the efficiencies, and C, we know that they're actually cheaper. Right? We know that that the elite quarterbacks are cheaper than they probably should be, right? Because the market wants to do other things. They want to do the roster, the wide receiver sex appeal. They want to do the dynasty bikini season and all that other fun stuff that everyone gawks at in June. Right. If our rosters are right, we're going to be way ahead. And I think this is a lesson in that. And I think that, you know, that this is an example of, it doesn't have to be perfect. A lot of times it won't be perfect. You're going to miss a lot. Again, 35% of my games of those seven guys that ended up missing games of my top 10 drafted players, 35% miss games. That's a lot of missed games. And still I was able to get through. And I think that that's a testament to a lot of the roster construction stuff that we know about, and B, just applying it and being sort of vigilant about doing that and being okay, being different. Right. So that's really the big lessons that I learned from this. Again, I wanted to share it and again, sort of preview some other research that I got coming out down the pike here to you guys. So, yeah, go ahead and check all that out. That'll be in the book there. And I hope that you enjoyed it. So that'll do it here for this edition, the Sunday strategy session. I guess the big takeaway, be right positionally. And, you know, elite players matter. Right? Those things on the back of your hand whenever you're drafting. That'll do it for this edition. Till next time, continue to embrace the variance. We'll talk again very soon.